The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We're on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Authors, plural, is the operative word today as we dive not only into the art of writing, but the art of collaborating. Today's book, Make Them Cry, is both a Mexican drug cartel thriller as well as a literary fiction writer's delight, as it's as much character study as thriller joyride. It's a collaboration between two friends, two writers, two drinking buddies, and two complete masters of their craft. John Mark Smith teaches English at Texas State University and lives in San Marcos, Texas. Smith Henderson is the author of Fourth of July Creek and lives in California and Montana. Fourth of July Creek, as you may recall, won all kinds of awards when it came out in 2014. Smith was on the show with me back then talking about it, so you can find a podcast of that discussion in our archives. Make Them Cry is their first novel. It's published by Echo, and it will drive our chat this morning. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, hi, thanks.
So any story that starts with this one time when we were on ecstasy at Tim O'Brien's wedding is going to be a good story. So rumor has it that's where this book began. And I don't know what's more interesting, the story of the wedding or the story of how the book came to be. But if either one of you want to tell us about that, I'd love to hear it.
Well, like many stories involving writers, it's only semi-true, but it is semi-true. We did attend Tim O'Brien's wedding, and it was either 2002 or 2003, and we perhaps partook of some substances. And what I remember is that we wanted to work together then. I'm not totally sure the story itself was born at that time, but our partnership, I suppose, was born.
Yeah, we'd been leading up to probably some kind of mind meld of that sort from spending so much time arguing about literature and sports and politics and on previous occasions. So I think, it sort of clocked in for us at that moment. I was like, oh, we should do something together. And then after that, I just think we started, you know, spitballing ideas for what it would be ultimately.
Do not, by the way, endorse the use of ecstasy for mind melding. We're much older and wiser than we were back then. And none of the actual adults or people that were playing adults knew that we were doing any of this. So only we can be blamed for our youthful errors that we made when we were like 30 or something.
So funny. Tim O'Brien has been on the show a few times. And when I read that, I was like, well, I was asking all the wrong questions. Clearly, we were talking about the wrong stuff. But
I'm not even sure. He probably didn't even know we were there, really.
I thought any book about a drug war that starts while two guys are perhaps on some drugs and at a war writer's at a wedding, you know, perfect. It's got all the makings of success.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah.
So you two met, John Mark, you were in an MFA program, and it sounds like Smith was kind of hanging around the edges of it. So that's kind of where your friendship started. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's where the Tim O'Brien taught at Texas State and actually still does workshops and still does some official things. He still, like, I think he zooms into student workshops even today. But I took a workshop with him, and I was in the MFA program at Texas State. And yeah, Smith was like, you know, I don't know why he wanted to do this exactly, but he like felt like his own life wasn't enough of a torture, and he wanted to hang out with writers after hours, I guess you could say. And that's where we met each other. And he ended up actually auditing a class with Tom Grimes, the director of the program, and that's of the writing program at Texas State. And that's, I think, where we first sort of really kind of realized how simpatico we were in terms of craft et cetera.
Smith, I can't remember. Do you have your MFA?
Yeah. So then after that, after a couple of years, I got into the University of Texas MFA program, the Michener program. And so when I was there, I was taking some fiction. I was writing a lot of short stories and a novel, but I was also taking some screenwriting classes. And one of the things that came up was the opportunity to ultimately shoot a movie one summer based on a screenplay that John Mark and I collaborated on that was based on a novel he had been working on during his MFA that I was familiar with. It just seemed like a good chance to do that. So that's kind of where we started, was adapting a novel into a screenplay. And then, you know, interestingly enough, this project was originally a screenplay that after I published my novel, we'd been batting it around with a manager and as a screenplay for a while. And I think we were getting kind of frustrated with the process ultimately. And we were like, I said, you know, I think the easiest way up the mountain on this thing would probably be to write a novel. And I think we could probably do it. So we opened up a Google Doc, I think at that point, and just started collaborating. And we had lots of conversations about different stylistic choices and things to work on, but for the most part, it was pretty natural.
It's crazy to have this not become a screenplay. Like after I was done with it, I'm like, this is so naturally a screenplay. So do you feel like that door is closed to you now?
Oh no, not at all. We, I have this very, I think our collaborations are always, and this guy, I think this extends to everything I write. Sometimes the thing you're working on isn't the thing that you think you're working on, you know? So this thing could easily adapt into, you know, feature if we got a, you know, opportunity or interest in doing that. Or right now we're focused on continuing the story and writing some more books. And I think like that's sort of a creative decision, sort of a strategy, I guess, of the project overall. But really what it comes down to is just like doing whatever thing you're able to do at that moment, you know? So that's kind of what we're thinking now.
So before we dive into the book, you both sound like born writers. And Smith, you and I talked about this last time. But I know at least for Smith, you've had a couple of weird jobs along the way. I think you were a prison guard and I know you were a social worker for a while. I'm kind of wondering, like, what has been your best preparation for this job? Like if there's stuff in real life that provided this sort of well of grit that you guys draw from when you're writing, or if it was the MFA, or if it's simply a bunch of reading, but were there jobs out there, kind of weird jobs out there that you feel like prepared you well for writing?
You know, for me anyway, despite those, like I was a cook, you know, like a dishwasher or stuff like that. You know, I did work in the inspiration for, or the, you know, a lot of the ballast of my first book about a child protective services worker was based on working in a group home here in Montana for many years. And, you know, and then when I moved to Texas, I briefly did a stint at a prison, like a real low security prison that was like really, really a dark time in my life. No, it was a pretty intense experience, you know, and I was like, this isn't for me. The truth, the honest answer to your question is every chance I got, I've taken the writing job I could get, you know? So whether it was freelance writing for my local independent rag, you know, doing like movie reviews if they'd let me or something like that, or, you know, working in corporate communications, you know, if I get a job that had me paid to write, I always felt like that was probably an advance in some way. So I always look at it as very vocational, even now, you know, it's my practice. It's something that's important to me, like the way karate or stamp collecting or something might be, but it's also like I look at it like my job every day, or, you know, try to.
How about you, John Mark?
I think both of us feel, we're both really interested in the stories that are born out of anyone's work. You know, I think like the kind of TV shows that we like or movies that we like oftentimes the characters get into problems because of their job. Now, I mean, that may be like a, you know, a kind of job like being a mob boss that not everybody has, but, you know, Tony Soprano's job has connections to your everyday average person's job too. And I think the thing that interests me and it interests Smith too is the pressures that come from work, from what, because they're very different than the pressures that come from regular life, because you're not necessarily doing the thing because you really deeply want to do it, you have to do it. And the pressures are really like, there's like multiple different ones. It's like, you know, I want to get paid more. I want to rise up in the organization. I want to not get fired, whatever it is. It's like, they're really, I think the kinds of things that people do, that characters do under the pressures of their job or their career or whatever, are things that are really rich in terms of storytelling. And I also think it's something that we, like, basically everybody has some kind of experience with, and you can take it, you know, you can take the experience that you have. If it's just, it's like sitting in a boring Zoom meeting about, I don't know, you know, a conference, a committee on something at your job, the kinds of things that you have to deal with, like, even if it's just being bored or trying not to make faces about the dumb thing that Shelley from marketing is saying or whatever, you know, like those kind of things, you can translate them into you know, the kinds of things that, say, a DEA agent is dealing with, even if you've never been a DEA agent or a mob boss or whatever. I just think that, like, work really gives, I mean, it's so rich in terms of what you can mine for. It's not exactly material. It's just like more like the ways that people react to situations that are pressure filled or difficult or whatever.
So neither one of you took one for the team and started running.
I guess we both kind of did the things that weren't necessarily, you know, for research. You know, I spent a lot of time going to visit the office down in LA, the DEA agents there, and sitting in their offices and looking at the places where they get coffee and, like, learning about all of the way, like, the different things that they do and their backgrounds and stuff like that. And it was pretty, that stuff was not always, like, simple or easy, you know, because they're like, what are you here for? But then they're also, like, willing to talk. And it was super interesting to be, like, you know, I didn't get to be a fly on the wall, unfortunately, you know, like, where it was like, okay, I'm immersed in this world. So you had to kind of refract, like, what you were experiencing through their filters, you know. And it was pretty fascinating. And I don't know, Jean-Marc went down to the town that we, you know, depict in much of the book, Tampico. When did you go down there? Like
last year. Yeah. Last year.
I really wanted to get into that. Well, let's first introduce the book, and then we can really get into the kind and method of research you guys did, because I am fascinated by how that went. But just to set the stage, if one of you wants to kind of introduce the scope of the book so we know, you know, a little bit about the characters and who we're talking about, and then we can kind of dive into that nitty-gritty research.
Okay, sure. So the book is about this, it kind of opens with this DEA agent named Diane Harbaugh, she's at the beginning of the book, this pretty shocking act of violence sort of throws her career into a lot of jeopardy. We kind of come to find out that she has been really, like, taking risks in her job and doing them, and has been doing them even in her previous life as a district attorney. And things have kind of come to a head for her such that she's really afraid that she's going to, like, lose her job. And in the midst of this, she gets a call from a cartel lieutenant in Mexico that she had given her card to many years before. And he wants her to come down right away. And this is the kind of thing, we can talk a little bit more about research, but this is not the done thing. But she goes down there anyway, and doesn't just have trouble with not following protocols on that, but uncovers some things that are pretty shocking and wide ranging, involving, you know, upper echelons of the U.S. government and the cartels. And yeah, I guess that's kind of it. And it kind of spins up, obviously, complications ensue.
It's so funny, because I would look at something that feels so overwhelming, like, you know, I'm going to infiltrate the KGB in Russia, that it just looks hard to penetrate and hard to understand. They're, you know, it's a world in and of itself, right? Yeah. And so that's why I'm so fascinated by the research is, you know, so you call up the DEA on the phone and you say, hey, I want to come down there.
And they say, yeah. I mean, the nuts and bolts on that stuff is, well, I remember hearing this from a couple of different instructors. Even I had some pretty great mentors, like Stephen Harrigan at the University of Texas mentored Jean-Marc and I both, actually. And I remember him saying at one point that people just call them. People love to talk about their about their area of interest or expertise. Like, and there's literally, you know, a press officer there that you speak to first, but then they find out kind of what you're working on. And I think that goes for, like, if you wanted to learn about Scrimshaw, or there's a gal somewhere who knows everything about that, you know, and would be happy to talk to you. So I always did that in this book and in our previous books. It's just really starting there. And then you uncover the complications. Like, I don't think we knew that she was previously a district attorney until I talked to one of the DEA agents who was, and about that move from the courtroom to the field. We didn't really know how that would work, if you, like, what kind of trouble you would actually get in if you just decided to go down to Mexico by yourself to meet with somebody. They show that a lot on screen. You know, you'll see, like, someone do some daring thing, and they don't really talk about, like, the kind of piles of trouble you're creating for yourself. I mean, it's often this moment of, like, leave your badge and gun on the desk and whatever, but this is, like, what really happens, you know? And we found out, oh man, this would involve the State Department. This might be a conversation that goes all the way up to the cabinet, you know? Like, what is your person doing down here if it escalates in the ways it does in the book? So it was fascinating to realize there were just these realms that spin out. So I love that stuff. Joe Mark does too.
I think one of your characters even said, you know, there was a recurring theme of, you know, there's tunnels within tunnels within tunnels. And I was thinking about that in the writing of it. You know, there's tunnels within tunnels of there's a lot of backstory that informs one character's life from, you know, Afghanistan. I mean, there's just a lot of layers that I'm like, damn, that's really a lot to bite off. And you just did it methodically. John Mark, tell me a little bit about, so your plane lands in Tampico, or your bus drives, however you got there. And what do you do? What are you looking out for? Who are you talking to? Kind of, how did that research go?
Well, the Tampico research was more like, it was really kind of some of the last stuff that we did. For one thing, because Tampico was to some degree and is right now, or at least was last year. I'm not totally sure what's going on there right now, but was very, very safe. Like, one of the reasons why we chose it is that it was territory that wasn't owned by any particular cartel. It was, like, split. And it also, there were a few years in the late 2000s, early 2010s, where there was a large amount of violence. This is when the drug war was at its absolute peak. But it was really, like, a very chilled out, fun, great place. I mean, I who knows if anybody can take any vacations or go anywhere
anymore,
anytime, right? But it's a really, really cool. It's a really cool city. For one, it's the people that go on vacation there are Mexicans, so it's, like, not full of, like, tourists from, you know, like, Germany or the U.S. or Australia or anything. It's like a really, it's a really, really cool place. Lots of great history. It's kind of like the New Orleans of Mexico. But I basically, doing the research in Tampico was just, we wanted to get a sense of, like, what the atmosphere was like, what the air smelled like, what the people seemed like, the you know, all the kind of flavor. And we had done a fair amount of, just, like, looking at the streets and things on Google, like Google Earth, Google Street View. So it wasn't so much that I was doing any research in Tampico about actual drug cartel stuff. Like, that had all been done on the front end, you know, by, like, just reading tons and tons of books and looking at everything I could look at, that we could look at. So the Tampico stuff was kind of like the last thing. And I wanted to feel like what the streets felt like when you were there.
Did you have sort of a guide through there? Do you find a contact there to walk you through?
So my Spanish is very iffy. I mean, I can read it okay, and I can semi-communicate in it as long as I don't let myself be embarrassed about what I'm saying. So I had to, an old friend of mine, whose name is Oscar Rodriguez, who's a native speaker of Spanish, he came with me, and we just sort of rolled around and, like, we would talk to cabbies and talk to, you know, various people. And we went to all these different places around the town. And it's really, it's cool. It's like there's refinery stuff. There's the beach. There's like the old city. There's all these crocodiles everywhere. You know, they were still sort of talking about when Steve Irwin visited and like wrestled some crocodiles. So it's like a really, it's a really cool place. But yeah, and Oscar had never been there. We just got on the bus and went down there and just sort of like walked around and talked to people and saw what we could see.
How did you choose it?
We chose it because it was a city that wasn't owned. Okay. So it was like a place where the character Gustavo, so Gustavo is fleeing. He's a high up in a cartel and he's taken off. He's gone, you know, he's gone AWOL and his cartel is looking for him. But Tampico wasn't owned by another cartel. So he felt like it was a place that nobody would know. Like it wasn't a place it's a shipping town. So there's lots of shipments that come in, but it's not a place like Monterey or Juarez or any place like that, that is either being fought over or is owned by a cartel. So he thought it was fairly safe for him to go to.
I got it.
And it's on the beach, and I figured, hey, I can go. It looks cool. It's awesome. Why not just like get, you know, why not be efficient in this and sort of get something out of it? I can go on vacation.
I was going to say, that's how I would choose all of the settings of my novels, is right. Where would I like to?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty good strategy, really. Why choose a place you don't want to go? Who's going to want to read about a place you don't want to go?
Go to Juarez or Tampico, and the choice is obvious. The choice.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So I understand that the book was kind of written, or it was kind of thought through, fleshed out, and then a shift was made, right? Then you kind of decided, oops, maybe we wrote the second book first and we got to back up. So tell me a little bit about the book that you initially wrote that kind of got tossed going to be the second book, or tell me a little bit about that realization that, whoops, we started at the wrong place.
Yeah, that wasn't fun. it was pretty clear to me though on some level when what had happened is we had written, you know, a partial, it's what they, you know, a certain amount. We figured it felt like we'd written about a third or more of the book, and you know, we turned it in and we got an offer on it and an editor that was, you know, keen to work on it. But I, you know how like you, I couldn't tell if I was paranoid, but you know, when you kind of read a room and you're like, something feels off, or, you know, like it just felt off. I don't know why, you know, I couldn't figure out why. And I was just like, well, it's no one's telling you this. It's you, you're having a problem with this. What is your problem? You know? And the more I thought about it, the more I began to see things like, oh, this chapter is boring me because it's, is all backstory or all exposition. And I was like, why are we writing it like this? And then it finally just dawned on me, we started too late and we're having to explain things. We're having to go back and set up things. And I just realized we had a pile of material that was being condensed, and oh crap, I think we need to start earlier. And so called up John Mark, and I think he thought about it for a little bit, and then he was like, yeah, I think, you know, I trust that. I think you're right. Cause I was happy to say, or we just figure it out, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but my thing is always, you can definitely write the wrong thing and be overcommitted to it and stuck, you know, it's like, well, it's time to be done. There are these pencil down moments where you just, oh man, I hope this is okay. Nothing is ever perfect. But this was a situation where I felt pretty strongly that we needed to step back and take another look at it. Your question about what is that the next book? I mean, so much has changed between now and then. There's chunks of it that will, I'm sure, be repurposed or used. And all of the imaginative work that you've done doesn't go anywhere, right? So I'm someone who likes to write way too many words and then do just a lot of violence to the page and cut stuff out, you know? So I never feel too bummed out if like it's baggy or something like that. It's just an opportunity to make it new and fresh, you know?
It strikes me that that is one of the really great advantages of collaboration is that, A, you have somebody else to talk it out with, so you have another, you know, point of view, rather than sitting in, alone in your closet drinking, saying, oh, I screwed up the last 5 years of my life. maybe I'm just projecting, but...
no, that's right. That's exactly right.
But but you know, you would have another partner to, A, hold you accountable, hold your feet to the fire, and hold all of the ideas feet to the fire of sorry, this isn't working, you know, and be able to talk that through seems like such an advantage.
You can always get someone to read a draft of a thing, right? You can find someone if you polish it, but they're not going to be invested in the solutions that, you know, the problems that they discover in the same way. So yeah, it was always invaluable to be able to like just literally jump on the phone and say, okay, chapter five, remember the scene when we're talking about this, it's not working. She says this, he's doing, it's just something's not happening. How do we fix it? And you can talk on the phone about it for 15 minutes or something and go, all right. Okay. Let's try that, you know? And you just can't do that unless you actually have an investment in the work and in the partnership.
Right.
It definitely makes you a lot smarter, you know, because you're able to piggyback on somebody else, right? And you're able to you yourself are not able to see everything, and so having the other person looking at something and just two brains on it is really, I think it brings like a pressure to the project. In our case, it brings a pressure to the projects that we're working on that really helps refine what we're doing and to make it stronger. Because, you know, like I if that had just been Smith or I writing that book alone, one, you may not have been able to see it, right? If it were your own writing, you might not quite get it. You also might not feel like the level of responsibility to fix it either. You might just be more willing to just say, whatever, if this is a bad book, it's my bad book, and I'll just go forward with it. And you know, whereas like if it's somebody else, it's like, oh, I don't want this to be a bad book that this person wrote too. So I think in some ways, like, that was actually it was the pressure of like the partnership, you know, the responsibility, I should say, that Smith felt to the partnership that allowed him to be able to see that. And I'm really, really grateful. I mean, we're both grateful to him for doing that. It made it much, I mean, it was absolutely the right decision. It was also real hard because we basically were going to be able to get paid after we had been working on it for like 10 years. Then it was like, oh no, we're not going to, now we just have to basically say, we don't want your money. Because we were stupid enough to give you the wrong book. So that was very hard to do, but it was the right thing. Absolutely the right thing.
Oof. So I've only tried to collaborate once with somebody else on a writing project. And we got kind of, you know, we got 6 months or something into it of a bunch of scenes and hashing everything out. She's an African-American writer. And at some point, one of us wrote a scene and I'm like, wait, are all of our characters Black? And she's like, yeah, of course. And I'm like, really? I thought, I didn't know that. And I was wondering if that ever happened to you, because, you know, so much in the writing process is in your head, making assumptions. You have to translate that to the reader eventually, but you guys have to translate that to each other. And I was wondering if there's a point in this when something like that happened, where you're like, oh, wait, I didn't know we were talking about that. We were really talking about this, you know?
Right. Well, I'll say one thing on that is that, and maybe John Mark has a better answer, but my first thought was just what I was doing this morning. I know we have this guy who lived a character, kind of secondary character in this book, who's his defining experience of his life was living through the siege of Sarajevo. And I just happened to find an account of it during my pointless rambles on the internet today. And obviously bookmarked it and sent it to myself to read and was just, often I think we think at the beginning about the characters, like who would this person, you kind of have a sense in your mind, like we need a certain kind of chess piece, you know, we need a bishop for the plot, but who that person is, I think, is kind of the fun part to spitball and talk about. So I find that as much fun as figuring out the plot. is reworking those people, you know, and putting like their histories together and figuring out, you know, who they are.
Did you guys have like physical pictures of the people? So you both had the same dude in mind?
I mean, we would talk about the characters so much on the front end, because the way we started off the process was we talked for a really long time about like hammering out every single aspect of the story, even though it didn't always stay, it absolutely didn't stay that way. But you have to sort of, when you start off, or at least this is the way we did, I don't know if it has to be done like this, but the way we started off is like, we imagined every single aspect of the world and the plot and like all the plausibility stuff and the realism and all the issues. Like, we talked about all that in detail for months before we started writing sentences, really. I mean, we took notes and stuff, but we didn't write any sentences until we had hammered all that out. And a lot of that is just like, that's generally the way that screenplays are done. So I think having the experience writing screenplays and then starting this as a screenplay actually allowed us to do a ton of sort of pre-writing work before we did the actual writing of sentences. And I'm not sure, I mean, we would have a sense of like sort of like who the people are in terms of their, I guess what you could call their demographics, I guess, the characters. But I don't remember us having like we would sometimes have conversations about who could play them. Like, mm-hmm. It sort of started off where like maybe George Clooney could play Carver, but then it was like, it took us 15 years to write this thing, so George Clooney was too old by the time we got finished. So I think it was just more like, yeah, this person could be Diane, or this person could be Tomas, or this person could be Gustavo, like that. But not, I don't ever remember it being like where we were really actually very married to that exactly.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Smith Henderson and John Mark Smith. The book we are talking about is Make Them Cry. As I mentioned at the beginning, so much of this book is really character study. I mean, obviously it's a thrill ride. It's a joy ride through a drug cartel. So there's a ton of action. But really, I mean, the part that I enjoyed as a literary fiction reader was the character study. And these guys have such rich backstories. I mean, my favorite character kind of by far was Tomas. He's this Sicario who used to be kind of a nerdy kid. And he, you know, was into this fantasy fan fiction. So I would think that would be the real fun, was coming up with these people's backstory and what drove them and, you know, just their weird little obsessions. And, you know, I don't know if one of you kind of took the reins on one character more and what propelled them, or if that was entirely collaborative as well.
A lot of our goal when we do this is to be working on it so closely and that you kind of can't remember who wrote what thing. But I do remember in the earlier version of this, John Mark taking a pass at a sort of history of Tomas. And it was really one of those things where, you know, I was like, monsters are people too. You know, this guy's really dangerous and deadly. And yet I just had an incredible amount of sympathy for him when John Mark had kind of come up with some of this stuff. And then it just kind of, the spirit of that just kind of was the germ of that character, you know?
And it really kind of rippled through as, you know, he's reading some fantasy fan fiction book, but that book, which I think is totally invented by you guys, because I actually went to look it up because I was like, well, I'll check that book out.
Funny, we should write that book, actually.
We actually wrote we wrote a lot of pages, like in earlier drafts of the book there were a lot. So that book is it's the twin dawn.
Yep.
We wrote tons of pages, I mean, like not tons, but probably like 15 pages or so of that actual book. And then everybody was like, no, take this out. You can't have this in the book. Our agent was like, stop it. Our editor said, cut it. So no one wanted that.
Meanwhile, I'm over here looking it up on Amazon saying, I'll read that. That's it.
See, but they were absolutely wrong.
They were wrong.
I can't wait for them to hear how wrong they were.
But it also became sort of a little rippling subtext, right? Under the rest of it, like it kind of informed the rest of his character throughout. Like it, you know, it became kind of who he was and kind of what, I don't know. I just thought it was great.
I like that stuff where, well, that's what it's, I mean, one of the things we liked about him, I guess our favorite thing is that he's a reader.
Right. So, yeah.
And you know, if you're a reader, you know what life is like as a reader. You're deep in a book and that you're out doing your daily stuff, and that book, you know, is part of the your mental landscape and can't help but cause you to reflect on things that are occurring around you through that lens of that narrative, that other narrative you're in.
Right.
So he was like the joy of reading character.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because the fact that he's a reader gives him the sort of interior space to have, like, he has, I would really say he has more of like a sort of spiritual interior space, access to a more spiritual interior space than the other characters do.
Yeah.
Just, I simply think just because he's a reader, like he recognizes the doubles that he sees and everything. And he's sort of a double because of, you know, the book is the Twin Dawn, et cetera. And I think he would be the only one that might even sort of know what it means to be doubled or what that kind of literary doubling is. He wouldn't talk about it like an academic or anything like that, but he would definitely understand like how it works in a story. Whereas the other characters, as smart as they are, I just don't think they would really have access to that.
Right. Smith, you had a great observation about character, which is the main character, which I think is how Diane came to be the main character, has to serve a bunch of roles. Something Jean-Marc just said reminded me of that she has to be both the smartest and the dumbest character in some ways. She has to be, you know, the light and the dark. They've got to carry kind of this duality that holds the reader, I guess, in this case, through multiple books. But all the characters kind of seemed that way. I mean, they all were really functioning with this duality.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons. I mean, one is that you've got some people that are all of them enmeshed in a biggest war in the world that's been going on in my lifetime. You know, since the end of the Cold War, this is like the most. And so the kinds of choices that people have to make in that environment are high and high stakes, and also do a lot of violence to your soul, you know? And so you have to be a little bit of, there's a darkness there. That's like, the other thing I think too, though, is just for stories to work, characters have to do the wrong thing at some point. They have to make mistakes. They have to take chances that other people won't take. And all of them are definitely living in that world. And Diane seemed to be the most, you know, when we originally had this, she was later in the story, she wasn't the main character. You know, and now she is. And the reason why is because the things she has to decide to do are the most interesting ones. The risks she takes and the journey she's on is the most interesting one. And I think partly came to us too when we moved to the novel. We moved the story backward a little bit and we got into the novel, and I think we just saw that she just had the most interesting journey.
One writerly choice that I thought was really fun and interesting, Jean-Marc, you said you're not a Spanish expert. I don't know if Smith speaks Spanish, but
I don't know, what would I say? I have like second grade Spanish or first grade, probably something like that.
Well, you have, then I must have like preschool Spanish, because I took it in high school, but there was enough Spanish in here. You could figure it out, but it was still a level above. You know, there were times when I had to look stuff up. I didn't know what was going on. So there's a lot of acronyms, DEA acronyms and Afghan, you know, war acronyms. And so I really liked that it assumed a sophistication or a knowledge body in the reader that the reader might not necessarily have, that was just a little out of grasp, but that, you know, if you spend any time at all, would become quickly in grasp. And I liked that. I mean, I really liked that it was not always spelled out and easy. And I was wondering if that was, you know, it made it feel very immersive, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I don't know how much you grappled with, how much Spanish do we include? How many acronyms do we include?
Yeah, I mean, it was always some, I mean, we always wanted to make sure that there was enough that it made the world seem like the actual world, right? Since so much of it takes place in Mexico, you know, obviously the whole thing can't be in Spanish, but we wanted to have enough and have it be the right words. And so my friend Oscar helped me out when I was down in Tampico. I just picked up on lots of things people said and wrote them down. Her name is escaping me right now, but the line editor who worked on our book for Echo is from Mexico City. So we had like a lot of assistance, and I know, you know, some I can, and I read a ton of books about just the drug war in Mexico over the past 20, 30 years. And that also helps quite a bit. But yeah, we want to be like really generous with readers, and we want to, you know, we absolutely don't want to talk down to readers. And I think the best, like oftentimes the writers that Smith and I most admire are writers that, it's not that they throw you in exactly to the world, but they present you a world that seems full formed and don't tell you exactly how to read that world. And you have to figure it out. I mean, and that can be like, you know, it could be like a world like John le Carré's, right? That's like pretty esoteric to most people, you know? And so you go into a John le Carré book where you're like, oh, I'm going to learn a lot about spies. I'm going to go to a world that I don't know much about. But it could also just be like, I'm just thinking like, okay, like Rachel Cusk, you know, it's like a lot of people know about workshops, but you have like a writer like Rachel Cusk, and she gives you it, the world. I don't know how to express this exactly, but the world seems fully formed, and like you're just looking in on it. And it's an actual world, but she's not telling you everything about it. She's just like letting you peek inside of it for a little while. And then, you know, you close the book and it goes away. But I think it's like a generosity with readers. And you, obviously, though, some stuff has to, you know, you don't want to confuse people. So it's a really difficult line to walk.
Yeah. Sometimes you have like all this. The funny thing is like you often, I think you find, you're in this situation where you have way more knowledge than you can use, or details or specifics. Like you finally understand the mechanics of a certain thing, you know, a certain protocol, for instance, like chain of command stuff or something, like, you know,
yeah.
and you realize it gets in the way if you actually spell it all the way out. So you have to convey the structure that you understand without belaboring the reader with all of your learnedness and look how much I know now, you know?
Right. And how many fictive leaps can you, I don't want to give anything away, but there's a scene in a prison in Mexico. And I'm just wondering, like, does the structure of the prison work kind of like that? Or was that a fictive leap of maybe it could work like this? We just don't know.
I mean, I did not go to visit. but we did, we were able to find a fair amount of like photos and videos.
Yeah.
And like, so to like actually see what different prisons, and even in that part of Mexico and around Topo Chico, like look like. But then we also read about different things that had happened in Mexican prisons where they were like either taken over or were actually like the people were let go to go, you know, let out to go do assassinations and then let back in. So like that stuff it didn't actually happen, but it's all based on some kind of reality.
Wow. Well, that brings me to the question about writing. You know, I talk to a lot of writers about writing tricky scenes, sex scenes, fighting scenes. So writing torture, you know, I'm not giving anything away here to say it's Mexican drug cartels. So there's some unsavory, uncomfortable scenes here. And that's tricky, right? Because when you show it on TV, you know, your viewer can close their eyes and hope it goes over by the time they come back with their beer. But reading it, you know, it was such a delicate line to walk. And in a book, you're obviously inside the character's head. So you've got the psychological torture along with the actual torture. And those just strike me as really tricky scenes to write. So I'm wondering, like, do you guys have rules of, you know, in mind of writing rules about how much a reader can take and how to dance through those scenes? Because they were so good and it strike me as hard to do.
Thank you. I mean, that's really kind of you to say. You don't know for sure whether you're hurting the reader, you know, until they tell you, which is kind of, which is ultimately too late, right? So, but my focus when I am looking at any scene that has an intensity to it, be it like an argument or something romantic or violence or physical activity, you know, is trying to get at the thought process, like what you're focusing on, what you're looking at, what you're wondering. Sometimes it's, and it doesn't even necessarily have an emotional content. I think there's a moment when a character is looking out a window and sees a cat. And I remember thinking, wow, something awful was going down and you could see a cat. What would that be like? And then it was like, just show the cat.
Right, right.
and that's almost enough. I think you get a little bit into her, like into the scene where you're kind of pleading, but it just, you know what I mean? It just kind of like, so you can do things like that are almost just purely experiential that aren't about the gross stuff, but that are really more haunting any because of it. That's the kind of stuff I like to read anyway. That's all I'm trying to do is imitate something that I've, you know, without specifically knowing it, just going like, oh, okay, that's what I'm trying to do here. I would like to read this way.
Well, I guess that's kind of what you would do on camera too. Like the camera would pan out to the cat out the window and you know what's happening, but we could focus.
Yeah.
On, yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. That makes sense. And it seems like if you're just focusing on the facts, it's a little bit, you know, rather than overly emoting about what the, you know, characters, you know, screaming or crying, all that emotive stuff. If you're just like recounting, this is exactly how it happened. It's scarier, right? I think.
Well, and this goes like, I mean, just to dive a little deeper into the craft aspect of it. I mean, this to me is something that we talk about a fair amount where we might get the information on the page, but we're just saying the character is upset, you know, or the character is upset and then they're going to do this action X about it. When really the way I experience my life is more that I think a thought, I see a thing, it sparks a memory that causes me to say something, you know?
Right.
And you see those pieces. And I'm always thinking like, how can we actively think on the page? How can we show actual thinking or actual, you know, experiencing stuff rather than to me, which like, often you when you read, you're reading a report of what occurred. So does that make sense? I don't know if that
was... It does. Yeah, okay. It does. Anything you want to jump in with, John Mark?
Oh, I would just say, I mean, I agree with everything Smith said, and he definitely like brings to that focus on not just having reporting going on, but like actually trying to get into ways that characters think. He's really, really good at that. I would just say like in terms of I think neither one of us want to present anything, make somebody too upset to read, right? To keep on reading. But on the other hand, it's like you have to show violence. You're writing about the particularly violent world. So I think like we wanted to make sure that everything that we included mattered in terms of the drama and the character development, and, you know, be just like really Aristotelian about that. Like, do we need to see this? And
yeah,
if we do, like, let's do the best version of it. But I also, just to say, like, we actually, like, in terms of the violence in the book, it's like nothing compared to the actual violence of the actual world. When you read like about things that have actually been done over the course of the last 20 years by like, say, the Zetas, it's too much to even be able to put on the page, really. You just couldn't, you wouldn't be able to put, you like, you, I just don't think you could get away with putting it on the page. So you actually have to, in a way, like tone down the realism, really.
I was going to ask you that is this actually not so bad? And sounds like this is not as bad as what it could be.
I wouldn't want to go through it. That's for sure. But it sounds it's bad enough. But it's not as bad as it could be.
Right. It's not painting a strong career picture for becoming a drug lord. Yeah. Right. Well, and it's funny because you're battling. You know, I mean, I feel like a lot of readers and watchers are slightly desensitized from HBO, you know, I mean, we've seen, you're like, what else can you show us? And you know, the answer I think that you're both getting at is it's interesting when it's in the context of a character, you care about, what's happening to them. And it's not just a gratuitous, here, I'm going to tell you something gross that happened to, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I take all those points. And the point that it wasn't as bad as it could have been is the scariest point of all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Smith, you've always said, you know, you're onto something when you when you're writing about things that scare you. And there's nothing scarier than all of this, right? I mean, this is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty. Yeah. That's pretty scary stuff.
About as scary as it gets, right?
And I would just add, like, it's things that the one of the things that interests us so much about, you know, like the horrible aspects of this is it's like we feel like, not that this book is intended to be a lesson at all or anything, but we do feel like people in the United States need to like look a little bit more clearly at what our policies have done in terms of the drug war in the United States, but really in Mexico, that it's had this effect that has, you know, led to just immense amounts of violence that are, that you can, you know, directly tie to policies put in place by the United States. And turning away from that and not looking at it because it's ugly is, I don't think that's the moral thing to do. So in fact, like looking at it truthfully is something that, you know, I hope like it could maybe, you know, it makes people think maybe more about like the votes they make or the kinds of policies they support, et cetera. So I to me, like there is a morality towards actually showing how devastating the violence has been in Mexico over the last 20 years because, or in, and longer than that really, but the really bad drug war for the last 20 years because of things that the United States has done.
I'm really glad you brought that up because both this book, Fourth of July Creek did this as well, where it's not didactic. It's not preachy. Yeah. You're not on some soapbox. It just bleeds through the narrative of political, you know, just a very quiet political or not so quiet, mm-hmm. sometimes political, economic commentary on, you should open your eyes and see what else is going on and the role that we all have to play in it. And that was so subtly and beautifully done in this book and in Fourth of July Creek that I marvel. I mean, I don't know if you set out to send a message or that's just how it comes out when the story comes out, but it really was artfully well done.
That's really, really kind of you to say. Thank you so much. We both care about this stuff and about the kind of ways in which our world is broken and the ways, you know, we're impacted by these things that seem abstracted or like political or whatever. And this isn't about politics. It's just about the world is this way, but it's maybe it doesn't have to necessarily be this way, you know? And I don't, you know, but it's just like on some level, I feel like it's an enthusiasm for those ways of thinking about the world, of like looking at the world as how systems affect people's lives, how history affects people's lives, you know? So, you know, in some ways like this book, because we've been working on this for such a long time, but also it's sort of historical. It's set, you know, in the early 2000s. And we're sort of reckoning with those decisions as a country that were made at that time. You know, we're always in the flow of history. So it's just, you know, it's sort of interesting on a real nerdy academic level for us too, you know, but I think we want to just explore that stuff without, you know, telling you up front, like we're going to explore these ideas, you know, and histories. You know?
Well, as someone who hadn't devoted a ton of my life thinking about drug wars, to be reminded of how many systems in the US are in place that are dependent on the drug war and profiting from it was a good reminder for your average reader who doesn't necessarily think about it all the time.
Right.
And kind of a wake-up call that there are more people that have roles to play in this than the scary guys right across the border. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Both sides want to keep it going.
Right. Yikes. I should give a shout out before we go to tech. You know, we always talk on the show about the evils of technology and how it's such a distraction to writers and kind of a nightmare for creativity. But what a great thing that technology, I mean, you guys couldn't have done this, I don't think, before without a lot of calling cards and long distance bills. I don't know, mailing, you know, pages back and forth. So I think it is kind of cool that you had all of the, you know, Google Docs and Zoom and however you guys collaborate. you know, for writers to kind of rethink the role that technology can help in their writing, in addition to killing their creativity.
Yeah, I mean, we went through two. When we started, it was we were on iChat. Now it's FaceTime in Mac OS. We would not have been able to do this without FaceTime and without Google Doc. I mean, it just wouldn't have worked. I kind of think even if we were in the same city, we wouldn't have been able to do it. Cause I just don't think we would want, I don't know. For one thing, we've never done this. We've only done it a few times where we've actually been in the same room. So I'm not totally sure we would have been able to do it. There's something about just like being able to talk and not, I don't know. To me, at least, it's like we never talk with our video on, by the way. So because we don't want to look at each other. So there's something about being able to just talk and talk it out, you know, that really works. I kind of feel like if we were in the same room, at some point we'd just be like, let's go get a hamburger and a beer or something, or like, you know, right. We go on a walk and nobody takes notes or something right. Like that.
Right.
It just happened. That's what happens, actually, when we're together.
Yeah, we're alone together.
There's a book by that title, just out in time.
Right.
Well, I mean, I take that point, actually. I mean, that's why I love the radio format, is because, you know, there's something about auditory. I mean, storytelling was auditory back in the day, you know, before the...
Oh, yeah.
Before the pencil it was invented. So yeah, I take that point that if you can just kind of close your eyes and talk it out, and you know, it's almost easier to do it that way than to be sitting in each other's presence with a blank page sitting between you. I mean, I just think opening a Google Doc and having someone in there with you is just very comforting. I think if somebody writes something, the other person can comment on it, and writing so lonely that it strikes me as just really cool.
Oh yeah. That's probably the biggest benefit of it. It's just that we're lucky. We have the opportunity to kind of let our friendship manifest and work together, you know, which is awesome.
Well, and I imagine, to John Mark's point earlier, you know, that one of you's got some strength, the other one probably doesn't, you know, somebody's really good at describing a landscape and somebody's really good at backstory, however it works out, that you can bring all those strengths together. So it double the fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Any last minute words of writing wisdom, advice, stuff that you have picked up along the way, either in MFA or just in doing the work that has helped you guys?
So I really feel like once I was able to start being someone who did my work in the morning and I was on a fairly regular schedule, that had a gigantic effect on my right. I mean, it just had an effect on like my being okay with my writing, I guess. I mean, I did a lot of writing when I had really ragged and weird schedules, but I feel much more comfortable and okay with it. When I have a set schedule. Now, obviously, lots of people aren't able to do that. And I really think that's actually one of the benefits of, you know, you're more likely to have a regular schedule. And it's hard, like when you're 20s or teens or even 30s, like it's like you don't know, you're like you're working weird shifts or you're working strange times and you don't know if you're coming or going. And I just think that like having a set steady schedule, if you can do that, it really helps a lot.
Good point.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely essential. I mean, you just are what you do every day, right? So if you're not writing, then you're something else. And I think a lot of people have an idea that it's like this image of what it's like or what it feels like to write and be a writer. And when it doesn't feel inspired or awesome, you know, you're like, I'm just not going to do it. But the thing is there's always, I would delve into a lot of craft stuff. I like talking about craft still and looking at ways to trick yourself into doing it, you know. And one of the things is you can always be doing some part of the overall project. Like maybe you're not, the sentences you're writing just aren't there, or you just don't feel like generating new stuff. Go back and make your dialogue better. Just do an audit for the number of times you drop an F-bomb and like go take that out of dialogue and change it up. You know, there's always things to do. It's just, it's like home ownership or something. There's always a...
Never ending.
Yeah.
God, this was an amazing read on a lot of levels, and hats off to both of you. This was really fun. Already looking forward to the second one. Do you have any idea of how many there are going to be, or is it to be determined?
We don't know yet. We have the, you know, we took out some giant post-it notes and maybe this time we got on a video call and I put them on my patio window, you know, and blocked out, you know, the story beats of the next thing and the one after that and in less detail. And, you know, you just fill it in as you go. I am sure we will discover some huge mistake we've made and we'll want to change it and we'll change the whole thing, you know.
Well, that's the funny thing is once you have one published, like that's in concrete, no changing that, right? That's yeah. out there. So yeah, this was so fun. So Smith, I know you have a website, Smith Henderson. I just think it's smithhenderson.com. Yeah.
Smith, I think I had to put a dash in there.
Oh, there's a dash. Okay. Smith-Henderson.com. And Jean-Marc, I know you're on Twitter and elsewhere. We can find you there.
Yep.
Congratulations to both of you. This was amazing. And I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Marie.
That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.